Let's welcome political commentators Neil Jones and Tim Hurdle. Good morning. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Morning.
Hi, Tim. Neil was Chief of Staff to the then Labor leader Jacinda Ardern, before that Chief of Staff to the then leader Andrew Little. He is Director of Public Affairs firm Capital. Tim Hurdle is a former National Party advisor and was Campaign Director for National in the 2020 election. It is 8 minutes past 11, and let's get stuck in. Let's start with the Prime Minister having had some time overseas. Of course, there was the Queen's funeral. Then there was the appearance at the United Nations, which had a lot of profile because of the focus of many leaders criticising Russia and what's been happening in Russia. Classic case, Neil, of she seems to be fated overseas and comes home and faces a much more mixed reception, a much more challenging domestic agenda also. What does she come home to, and where are we at in the cycle, and how much time for the Prime Minister and her Labour team to turn a ship?
Yeah, look, I don't think it's unique that there are leaders who are sort of having a high profile abroad compared, and then, you know, a much easier run and come home to a difficult domestic agenda. That is the way of the world right now. I mean, Joe Biden has a very challenging agenda domestically, Macron, Liz Truss particularly. So this is quite common, and all around the world leaders are facing the same challenges around inflation and economic uncertainty. And I think that is what Ardern comes home to, is a country that still has a pretty shaky economic outlook, rising interest rates, and you know, and still challenges with inflation, but still some pretty good economic fundamentals. I think the challenge, as I outlined last week, is that Labour really needs to get its political radar back on track, really focus its agenda on the things that people actually, you know, actually matter to them, probably much more on family budgets. And I think really just get into that election year framing, because this election is one that they can win. It's one that, you know, Luxon is making repeated missteps. He has shown himself not to be a John Key. He has neither the skill nor the common touch. And while the economic terrain is against the government, I think this is a very winnable election if they focus.
Tim?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Going off on the world stage might give you a few positive TV pictures and potentially a bit of coverage in overseas media, but at the end of the day, it's not really connecting with the voters in New Zealand, because they sort of see that while they're at home dealing with higher inflation, with the constant problems that we seem to have on the news with ram raids and crime, it looks like the government's asleep. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, these sort of trips. I think the longer a prime minister goes, the more attractive it is to spend time overseas. I think we've seen that with most prime ministers in New Zealand. So it'll be interesting to see whether she's going to come back with a renewed focus and has thought through some of the issues that will have to be addressed quite aggressively if they're going to be in a position to be competitive next year.
I do want to push back on one thing there, which is there's some commentary I see that says that Jacinda Ardern is going overseas almost out of vanity or for fun, and that it's somehow disconnected. And I realise that, you know, it doesn't necessarily directly speak to the challenges at home, but she is doing things like, you know, she met with Liz Truss, for example, when she was over there, had an hour-long meeting, I think the first or one of the first leaders in the world to meet with Liz Truss, and they talked about the UK FTA, making sure that was on track. You know, she renewed her links with the EU, the leaders of the EU, who are the people that she worked with in the EU FTA. These things have direct material economic benefits to New Zealand. So I think actually, as much as it's tempting for some to dismiss it, I think the work that Ardern does overseas is actually critical to New Zealand domestically.
Well, let's get into the mood of the boardroom stuff. I was just grinning because from what we were hearing last week from our correspondent, the New Zealand FTA may be the only one UK gets signed in the foreseeable future. Things. That's another problem on the new UK Prime Minister's front at the moment. Certainly the US has said, don't hold your breath. Let's get to the mood of the boardroom stuff. Yes, it is a subset of voters. And a comparatively small subset of voters, but these are important players when it comes to the mood of the economy, the direction of the economy, and they, you know, they have a loud voice to them. It was a mixed scorecard, and interestingly, her communication, I saw one executive say, if you ask me about that, I would say off the charts. The number's not so good for other parts of the scorecard, however, but is it, in the circumstances, is it fairly predictable, Neil? Sorry, Tim, what did you make of it?
Well, I think you've got to give them a bit more credit. In 2020, a lot of these guys were giving, and girls were giving, very high marks to the government for management of COVID and the situation. So we have seen that they're not just traditionally marking it all one way. I thought the really interesting questions for me were the questions around government competence and some of those core areas where Grant Robertson has established a reasonably strong, had established a strong reputation. There were big questions around fiscal responsibility, around management of the labour shortages and immigration. And I think those economic confidence issues probably reflect the wider concerns of the public about where we're going with inflation, with some of the challenges we're seeing in the economy. The economic growth might be continuing, but those other issues that businesses face are going to hit pretty hard as we go on.
Yeah, look, I'm pretty cynical about the mood of the boardroom. If you looked at a political poll, this is probably around the top 0.1% of the right-wing vote in New Zealand, and has probably about as much credibility as if you did a mood of the trade union officials and asked them how much they like the National Party. So it does come from a very particular perspective. I think we did see in 2020 an increase in Robertson's favourability. Bear in mind, he was shovelling billions of dollars into those businesses at the time and saving them from collapse.
Kind of ironic when everyone's turning around now saying that's their number one worry. There's still an argument over whether it was too long and it's the Reserve Bank's job doing the shovelling.
Those businesses certainly weren't arguing it was too much and too long at the time. They were demanding more and faster, even if they criticise it now. So, look, I do think that what it probably reflects in part is that it is tough economic times. But again, I make the point, the whole world is struggling with this. The question is, how is New Zealand faring in comparison? And by every measure, we're actually doing pretty well. And so I think Grant Robertson does not get the credit he deserves. And I think it's pretty mean-spirited. And actually, some of it, I think, look, there were some smart CEOs there. There are some I know who are very good. But there were others there who were just ridiculous. I mean, one CEO was quoted by the Herald, completely uncritically saying, I don't like Grant Robertson because he's busy fulfilling the Heipuapua report. I mean, mad conspiracy stuff. And I just think that actually it's embarrassing for the Herald that they have put out, seems like half their paper, on a completely uncritical view from some of the most privileged and wealthy people in the country.
Completely out of touch with New Zealanders. I read it as slightly less, slightly more balanced response from many of the executives I was reading anyway than that. There was a bit of hyperbole there. There's no doubt about that.
I guess my point is it was utterly uncritical. And journalism is supposed to be about speaking truth to power. And this was basically transcribing the thoughts of those in power
as if it was an oracle. You balance some of the hyperbole by putting in the views of others with contrasting. And I think that happened. It's an important audience, though, Tim, for any government. It's one that might be, to Neil's point, typically, harder perhaps on Labour governments than others. But it is one that this and any government would want on board. And remember, there was the Prime Minister's Business Advisory Council. Some of these figures were involved with that, mind you, so is the leader of the National Party. What are they looking for out of this group?
Oh, I think it's a wee bit harsh to get to sort of write them all off as extreme right wingers or something like that. Yes, there's always a few people who have a different view, but from my experience, a lot of these people are actually the leaders on things like sustainability, about trying to push New Zealand into having a more positive overseas image around its supply chain being sustainable. They're often the people that are pushing for higher standards of health and safety, and they are usually very well informed. They're absorbing the data. They are talking to their teams and their economic analysis of where the market is moving. They've got a good insight into global trends. So you were making the point, Neil, that these are the people that we should be comparing to overseas trends. Well, these are the people that are talking quite often in these circumstances to Australian head offices or overseas reports. So they have got an awareness of the global economy probably more than the average man in the street or woman in the street.
So I think you have to take
on board that they do have a degree of education and knowledge about what's going on in the economy.
As I say, there are a number of the people quoted in there who I know and who I respect. So I'm not saying all of them, but we have to be realistic that if you take a slice of 100 CEOs,
that does not represent anything. We put that proviso on the start. But these are also people who are drivers, in many instances, of key parts of our economy, right? So again, as we said, you want a positive relationship and you want to be listening to some of their feedback. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that everyone in burped or whatever to a reporter during the process. And there were some burps in there. Just come back to what you were saying, though, which is the case Labor has to make, or the government has to make, about New Zealand's situation vis-a-vis everywhere else. A problem they have is that they can sit and make that argument and put the charts up and argue this, but people move on. This was Cullen's point. Whenever you gave someone something in the last budget, they put it in their hip pocket and they move on. And the question is how you speak to the current mood and the current concerns, not your charts about how you think you're doing comparatively. Now, that will be an important determinant of how they go in the next year.
Indeed, and that's why I think I do think the government does need to make the case that comparatively New Zealand is doing better than other countries, but they also need to make the contrast with what the opposition are doing. And I think that's the point I come back to is elections are not a referendum on the current government. They're a choice between two pathways. And, for example, I mean, if you look internationally, as we've been talking, I mean, Liz Truss in the UK has just done huge tax cuts for the wealthy, and the markets are falling through the floor, and inflation's about to spike. I think there's questions for Christopher Luxon, for example, about his tax cut package.
Okay.
But hang on. But just can I just jump in there, Catherine? Because the exchange rate in New Zealand has just hit a 10-year low against the Australian dollar, and we didn't do big tax cuts last week. There is a lot of challenge on the New Zealand economy, and the thing I went and tracked back on that, I said, well, 10 years ago, what was happening with the dollar, what was happening with immigration? Well, that was when we peaked in our net migration outflow to Australia. So we've got a lot of challenges that are going to come off the back of this around losing skills to Australia. We're already losing skills in labour, which is what those CEOs were concerned about. So this government's going to have to do something about its immigration settings. It's going to have to think about how it tidies up the labour market and gets us onto a positive future growth.
I think that's track. Where the listening really does have to happen, is what is actually happening in many of the industries and what the consequences are. I mean, another complication here is you've got the US going hard on inflation, so the US dollar is on the rise, and comparatively everyone else is impacted by that. Of course, that conversely helps our exporters with their returns. So you're riding an international wave, but you've got to tell the story about what you're doing domestically. And as I said, I don't think holding up the charts and saying, hey, look at these guys, is necessarily going to suffice.
No, and I don't think so either. I do think you have to tell a compelling story about what you're doing, why New Zealand's a better place than other countries, and what the alternative is with the National Party.
I know you traversed this last week when I was away at a business conference, ironically, which was kind of interesting, a different kind of business conference. It was a one focused on sustainability and in carbon, cutting carbon emissions, etc. But it was interesting to tag a mood there. And I agree with you, Tim. There are businesses now moving, and they're moving because consumers, particularly younger consumers and younger employees, are pushing them. And because, conversely, some of their trade relationships are also pushing them, EU in particular, which is moving very quickly. So they have stuff, absolutely stuff to bring to the table. It's a two-way street. But I know you talked last week about the bigger picture here and whether the government needs to jettison, Labor needs to jettison some of its bigger reform programs because it's you know, risking not being able to tick the box on any of them. One that business has now set its sights on is the income insurance. What are the arguments for the government here continuing to persevere or not, Tim?
Well, I'm just completely confused as to why they're bothering with it. We have a private market for income insurance. People haven't chosen to take it, but it's decided that this is something that people really want. I've never heard people saying they want it. That if they want it, they usually get told, we'll go and get some income protection insurance. So it's sort of become a something that it's just going to end up being a big argument about another tax, which I don't quite understand why Labor wants to have that argument.
What is the driver behind it?
So it was actually came about from the CTU and Business New Zealand working with Grant Robertson together, saying off the wake of COVID and the wage subsidy and also looking back to the GFC and saying when you have these times when there are major economic disruptions, it does help to have an automatic stabiliser in the economy so the government doesn't have to borrow billions of dollars to bail everyone out. And I think also from a sort of workers' perspective, the CTU was keen to support it. I think there's a lot of merit to it. I'm someone who's worked in the union movement. I've worked closely with people losing their jobs, or who risk losing their jobs. And one thing I know is that every single person who works for a living has in the back of their mind a fear that they're one phone call away from financial ruin. And if this can help to remove that, I think that's really liberating. Where I do think the government has a challenge is at a time when there is, you know, high cost of living, there's a lot of economic stress.
Very low unemployment.
And low unemployment, adding sort of even if 1.6%, it's a small amount, that does become a bit of a distraction in an election campaign. So if you were to be brutally cynical, or at least brutally trying to win an election, you'd probably at least find a way to reduce that cost or delay implementation, or find a way to not be fighting an election on adding a cost to workers. It is going to be a tough challenge for the government because, you know, Luxon will spend the whole campaign saying jobs tax, jobs tax, jobs tax.
You see, Tim, they're in the situation where they've been told they can't deliver things. And if they start jettisoning parts that are part of a large complex program, do they end up walking into that narrative even further?
Well, I think they need to put some runs on the board. And the advice that you'd get normally on this situation is scrape all the barnacles off the boat if you want to go faster. There's a lot of things that are really slowing them down because they've got so many fronts open. If they actually at least parked a few or put them out to the on a longer track and fixed a few of the bigger problems that are on their agenda, they would be able to start answering the question around delivery. They're going to run out of time otherwise, and everyone's going to sort of say, well, what have you actually delivered? And that becomes a pretty damning problem when you're trying to make new promises at the next election.
We'll come in a moment to the National Party leader's handling of the Sam Uffendall situation, because I know it was announced just shortly after you guys were on air last week. We'll come to that in a moment. But something that has finally triggered an investigation is the Minister, Nanaia Mahuta, Minister in multiple roles, local government, foreign affairs, etc., and claims of conflicts of interest, or rather management of conflicts of interest. Now, this has been bubbling quietly for quite some time. And was it time to get it dealt with, more than time, Tim?
Well, it has to be dealt with at some stage. I think New Zealand doesn't do a very good job of having oversight or watchdogs on these sorts of arrangements. It's probably, I'm not going to make any comment on the particular context, but I would like to see New Zealand was doing a better job about thinking about how it looked at oversight and review of how contracts are awarded. I find that we tend to award contracts in New Zealand, but there's no way of, short of an Auditor General's very light touch, scrutinising why that particular award was made or how it was to be administered. And you see overseas in things like Australia, they have their ICAC and anti-corruption commissions, which provide an outlet for this kind of issue, and it provides a clarity and a sunlight. But I don't think we have that in New Zealand in any way, and it really can lead to these sort of situations where it sort of bubbles along rather than an investigator, a professional investigator, taking it up, having a look and saying there's nothing to see here, which is probably the best outcome.
The argument that it's 6 degrees of separation or even less in this country, Neil, is that necessarily good enough, especially where you have multiple contracts awarded? And what is the way to build that factor in to a robust system?
Yeah, I think there's two questions here. The first one is, are the rules correct around how we manage conflicts of interest, and do we need to tighten them? As you mentioned, it is very hard in a country as small as New Zealand. You know, in Wellington alone, there are conflicts everywhere, and it's how you manage them that matters. The second question is, did Nanaia Mahuta do anything wrong? And I think those are two very separate questions. And there's no evidence at this stage that she has done anything wrong. She insists that she followed the cabinet manual and all the rules appropriately, and she referred herself to the PSC. And I think that is appropriate because it had become a story that was starting to dent the government's credibility, and I think they had to move to get that tidied away, and Nanaia Mahuta will be hoping that she is cleared by this. As I say, it is possible the PSC out of it recommends some changes.
PSC?
Public Services Commission. It's the new State Services Commission.
Right.
That's a whole other discussion. I do have to say I am a bit concerned that a lot of this has been driven by sort of quite a racialised discussion. There's been a sort of sense of Māori in the trough is kind of the narrative from some of the sectors this has come from. This did emerge out of sort of the murkier parts of the internet and has, you know, bubbled away for weeks and weeks and finally hit the media. And I have some of the vitriol and some of the racist language around it has been quite concerning.
Okay. Unfortunately, is just part of the universe.
It's
very unfortunate.
But I do wonder, and look, let's see what it says, but I do wonder if the same level of scrutiny would have been applied had it been a Pākehā male politician, and I don't think it would have.
All right. Let's have a look at the Uffendale case, and what did you make in the end of the way that the National Party leader handled this? A lot of questions asked Tim about the fact that not only weren't the terms of reference released, but there was no redacted executive summary. There was nothing really to back the decision that he made to maintain his MP, other than to say, people trust me. Is that good enough? Is it just going to recede into history now?
Well, I said last week I thought they'd be looking to try and put a full stop on everything. I was a bit surprised how narrow the investigation of what was presented was, because it sort of was very fixated on the allegations about what happened at university 20 years ago. I guess they were very hamstrung by the fact that he had actually disclosed the original situation, and I wonder whether the real scrutiny for the party will be behind the scenes on how they ended up in the internal management of this issue, because if he had disclosed it, the senior officials in the party and the political campaign machinery should have had a fairly good fix on how to deal with it and how to present it. So
isn't that a reason to release at least redacted contents then? Because you can actually shift the heat off Uffendale then, as Neil was arguing might be the case for Minister Mahuta. If he did what he was supposed to do, followed the rules, then wouldn't it be better to make that clear and say, hey, we made some mistakes internally in how we did this and we're going to do better? Otherwise, people wonder, don't they?
Yeah, I think that is the problem. They've left a few threads to be pulled. I did wonder too why there wasn't some sort of probation period put on Mr. Uffendale to sort of say, well, you know, he's proved himself, and you know, even if it was a nominal kind of thing, like, it sort of left a lot of questions that I think are going to keep going, because I can see that people like Neil will keep bringing them up on the internet and it'll keep going.
Well,
I do
think Christopher Luxon should listen to 9 to Noon's politics segment on a Monday, because twice on this show I've made the point that Labor has been in this exact situation with both the Maria Jew and the Austin inquiry into their own issues, and both times they released an executive summary which gave confidence that it was a proper investigation, gave an understanding and some confidence in the sort of investigation that happened, and kind of drew a line under both issues. And that he didn't do that, I think, was a remarkable failure of judgment, given how long he had to sort of sort this out. And I think for Luxon, I mean, this will fade away, I'm sure, but it does damage his kind of, I'm an outsider, I'm a CEO, I'm not like a politician shtick. Because actually he looked a lot like a politician here. Looked kind of grubby, hiding things, not being up front. And if you compare it, you know, if you look at what a CEO would do, I looked at Cam Wallace, CEO of MediaWorks, who used to work with Lux Media New Zealand, who when he had a report, he got Maria Jew, actually, she seems to be doing a lot of these, into workplace culture.
Yeah, but that was contemporary in the past.
But he released the full report.
Yeah, but that was because it was an existing situation or near history situation, right? So you've got to satisfy people. It's not an ongoing risk.
I think the point remains, though, that Cam Wallace managed to release an entire report and front it up and dealt with it. Labor released executive summaries of both their issues. Luxon remarkably thought he could hide the whole thing, and it just leaves questions, and it leaves questions about his judgment, and it makes him look like a grubby politician.
Thank you, Neil Jones and Tim Hurdle, our commentators.